Hello, everybody, and welcome to Weekly Manga Recap here on January 21st, 2015. I'm iWhirler of Time, and with me, as always, is Chris Rolo T. How you doing, man?
I'm doing okay, Nick. I'm gonna let you in now. In fact, yeah. If I sound a little low or I sound like I'm dying, I'm currently enduring a vicious headache right now.
Oh.
So at if any point during this podcast you hear a loud, sickening crash, that's probably my head hitting the desk after I pass out. You'd be a peach if you called the police.
That sounds very serious, yeah.
So, like, I'd appreciate it. You know, don't put yourself out. You know, the phone's really far away. Don't worry about it, but...
Well, yeah, I was going to say, it's like, it's going to take me a while to find your home address, man.
You could just be like, Podcaster, Pennsylvania. They'll be like, there's only one of those.
In all of Pennsylvania.
Or contact
your hometown, your entire
state. Yeah, not, the state of Pennsylvania. They're like, there's only one. Or you could contact our strong, supportive nation over in the United Arab...
United Arab Emirates, which apparently makes up 50% of our listener base, according to Podbean statistics.
According to that, yeah, we have a huge audience there. So you can contact them. They'll I'm sure one of them knows what to
do. I wonder if that's like some sort of default setting that you have to change from or something like that, or it just assumes you're from the United Arab Emirates or something.
No, I mean, it's, you know, it's its own place. I think it's just someone from there maybe clicked the podcast a whole bunch, because it goes that based off of plays. I don't think off of individual downloads or anything like that. So it could just be...
left it on, like, autoplay cycling through them for a while.
Yeah, it could be something like that, or someone really did just click it a whole bunch of times accidentally or something like that. It's just the fact that they're our number one listener is what I find awesome.
Not just number one, but with 50% of all plays.
They make up half of all of our listens, apparently.
That's ridiculous.
I think it's awesome. But no.
We can recap.podbean.com.
Go check it out there. Now, we're not doing Gekken Shoujo person's name, Kun. I keep forgetting what his name is, so it's just easier to just ignore it.
Yeah, it's on me this time. I didn't get to reading it until very recently, and then it was slow going. Yeah. So, unfortunately, I don't think that when we do actually cover it, it's going to have been worth the wait all that much, but...
I think it's still there. So we don't have a manga topic for right now. Had I known, I'd have probably prepared something, but it's, you know, I think we'll be fine. We'll go into the recap, because we've got some good chapters to talk about this week, and then we'll probably have some time.
Very, very... These will be conducive to discussion. Yeah. Or at least snark.
And then we'll probably get to some Q&A at the end. So, yeah, some good time. So, we're going to start off...
Yeah, recap portion of Weekly Manga Recap, and there's no Bleach this week.
No. No Bleach.
So, we're going right into what's probably going to be the highlight of the week, which is Fairy Tail, the final chapter of the Tartaros arc.
Chapter 416, and, you know, there's like a previous page. This is one of those weird, like, Hiro just wanted to draw more, and because Weekly Shonen Magazine has nothing else on the same level as Fairy Tail, they're just like, fuck it, do whatever you want. So there's a 33-page chapter this week with color pages, because he can. So it opens up with Lucy in the town. I forget. Oh, Magnolia. I don't know why. It's right there, but I could never... If they hadn't said it, I'd have been like, where the fuck is Fairy Tail's actual town? As Lucy is inside her home, looking out and kind of reminiscing about things, and it's a close-up on Aquarius's broken keys, where they're saying, and not all of our wounds are on the outside. And then we get our cover page, which is a color spread with all the Fairy Tail characters. Well... all the important ones, in winter clothing, and a polar bear of some kind is hanging out by there. And I find interesting is, like, this is one of the few times that most of the characters are in, like, weather-appropriate clothing, but somehow, for some reason, Lucy's still like, no pants. It's not worth it. Find that mildly amusing. Anyway, the chapter proper begins as Fairy Tail is basically remarking at the enormous crater that was once their home. Again. And Mira Jean even says, Master, is it possible to fix the guild this time? And they're just like, I don't know if there's like four different times of fucking magic we can use to repair our guild at this point.
I like how they're just like, let's not even bother this time. We've got to rebuild it so many times. Let's just call it a wash.
They're like, you know that time in fucking Dragon Ball Z where Goku was like, stop reviving me. Everyone comes to this planet to kill me. Just stop it.
pretty sure that wasn't his reason.
Maybe that was the dub. I could have sworn that after Cell, and he died there, they were like, we're going to bring you back. And he's like, no, don't, because every enemy who has come to this planet has come to kill me.
I thought it was just because he wanted to, like, check out the afterlife for a bit.
Maybe it was the dub that added that in, but I remember that being his reasoning. He was just like, no, everyone comes to fuck with me. Just leave me dead. Anyway, that's the logic I imagine Fairy Tail's guild buildings actually saying. Like, don't build me again. They're just going to destroy me.
And there's no point anyway.
It's worthless. And Makarov. I didn't
even last a full arc this time.
You barely even see me anymore. I show up to get exploded. And Makarov remarks that this may be the end of an era. And then we cut away to the hospital where Luxus is waking up. And all of his friends are around there hugging him. And Laxus hugs him and he says, I'm not strong enough to protect the people I love yet. Which is really weird because I know like Laxus has had character development. But it's still weird to see the character who was, like, the silent, cocky badass be the one that immediately hugs his friends, and I'm just like, I must protect the people I love.
There's a lot of just, I'm emotional now because of the arc is over moments in this chapter.
It's just kind of unique to see him in that position. And then we cut to the next page,
where, oh my God.
Where Wendy has regrown her hair back to normal.
So, that's the last straw, right? I mean, her cutting her hair was now just completely pointless. Just completely pointless. There was no reason behind it. She cut her hair to have a dramatic moment, and it ended up being not dramatic at all, because she never did anything. And then she just grew her hair back, so she didn't even keep the haircut she gave herself in the dramatic moment.
It's great because she wasted the one moments before she gave herself the dramatic haircut, she had done something. Like, she had stopped the one face bomb. So, if you wanted to have, like, given her this big, important haircut before she does something cool, then would have been the point to do it, and not afterwards, where the only thing she did was hang around and get really scared when the fucking dragon first showed up. But yeah, she did nothing with her haircut, Nick.
This would be like if, I don't know, if I did something, like, amazing, like, I saved a bunch of orphans from a burning building, and then I talked with the firefighters, and they said, yeah, apparently that there's a whole bunch of buildings on this block that have been set on fire and stuff, but we're combating the situation now, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to do something about this, and I, like, take off my jacket and throw it behind me, and I just strike a badass pose. But then, like, the entire rest of the fire department shows up, and they save the rest of the block, and I'm not needed to do anything. There are no orphans that I need to save, or anything like that. And so, then, afterwards, I'm just like, I'm cold, I want to put my jacket back on.
Give me my jacket back. Like, you start working out so you can save all these fucking children in fires, but then once all the fires are put out, you're just like, I didn't save any children since I worked out. I'm just gonna get fat again. Like, what was the point, Wendy, of cutting your hair? The only logic I can think of is that it, for some moment, maybe hit upon some other fetish of heroes that he likes to put out there. Because I know there was a point where
he was, like, intending to do the design change, but then after he drew Wendy a few times, he was just like, oh no, this actually doesn't look good at all. I'm just gonna go back to the old hairstyle.
It's possible, but I also remember during the, and I forget what the name of the alternate universe is, like the Old World or whatever the alternate, like, Fairy Tale universe was, where, like, Evil Urza. I remember Evil Urza and regular Urza fought, and then after they fought, like, the other Urza cut her hair really short.
Right, she had, like, a bob cut.
Yeah, like, and it was just like, why'd you do that? And, like, the kind of reasoning they gave it was like, oh, so she can tell herself apart. And I was like, well, how does that... I mean, you know who you are. You know the other Urza you're staring at isn't you. So, like, it may have just been that, you know, maybe hero is a thing for girls with long hair to cut their hair into shorter hair and then not have anything that really happens after that. Like, I just don't get it. I thought it was just... It's not, like, irritating or anything. It's just amusing to me that, like, she did that big, important haircut, and then this chapter, it's just nonchalantly like, wow, my hair's back to normal, twirl, twirl pose. Just like, oh, good. I'm glad this status quo was returned. Phew, I was worried. We then cut away to, Charlotte? Charles? What the fuck's a girl cat's name?
Carla.
Carla, that's it. Carla and Panther Lily. Panther Lily asks, like, how's Wendy seem to you? And she's like, same as always. Even after what happened, she's putting on a brave face. And for a moment, I thought she was talking about the haircut again. Like, she was just like, yeah, I know. She thought that short haircut was a terrible idea, but she endured it. But no, they're talking about the fact that they saw their dragons again, and then they departed. Panther Lily says that's basically exactly how Gajeel's doing, that he's holding up well despite the fact that it was tough on everybody. And we then cut away to Natsu and Happy in their hut, and they're talking about how much money they've saved and how it's not too much, but they'll just have to survive and make do. Then we cut away again, because it's a chapter of, like, where everybody is after this arc. And we see Gray up in his icy northern continent, where he has created a grave to his father, Silver. And he's sitting out there, and Luvia shows up, and she admits to him that she was the one who defeated the necromancer that was basically keeping Silver alive. And she takes the guilt for ultimately being the one to kill her father. Gray grabs her, and at first looks like he's angry, but instead he cries into her chest, and he says, thank you, and two of them cry together in the snow.
One of them says that the other is warm, but I can't really tell where the speech bubble's coming from.
I'd have to assume that it would be Gray saying it, because why would the person who's being hugged into...
Sense to determine that based. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be either though.
That little comment aside, I think this is like the only like really good moment in the chapter.
Yeah, it's a sweet little moment between them. That is like, you know, like a kind of good closing final moment for them.
Yeah.
We then cut away to Urza as she is seen on the riverbank overlooking some river, and she starts having flashbacks to when she was sexually tortured by Kyoka. And then has more flashbacks to when she was a prisoner inside the Tower of Paradise. And I don't... Like, it's
this
hard...
This is like Satellizer levels of, like, look, check out this sexy sexual torture. Oh, but it was traumatizing for her.
That's the thing. Like, I'm trying... Because they never suggested in any... at least I don't recall. It's been a while. I don't recall them suggesting there was any kind of, like, sexual torture when she was in the Tower of Paradise. She was just, you know, like... a prisoner, and it was, you know, fucking awful shit they did to kids. I'm really hoping that's not what they're trying to suggest here, that... Cause it's,
hopefully it's just like, oh, I was imprisoned and tortured.
Yeah.
I
don't like being a prisoner or a slave or whatever term they're going to use, but it's tough because obviously the image used for when she was with Kyoka is like her breasts like flopped out and fucking tentacles wrapping around her. You're just like...
Super fetish fuel stuff.
Man. I don't want this to become exactly like the issue was with Freezing, where you try to make a character have a sad sexually abused history, but then you constantly sexually exploit them. It would be like the fucking nail in the coffin that is the awful character of Urza.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Urza is, you know, monologuing to herself. I wish that memory would stay buried. It could still make me tremble. Betrayed, deceived, stripped bare, and humiliated. After all that, can I still manage to trust anyone anymore? And then, of course, fucking Gerard shows up in his, you know, time saver cloak. I forget what their group's name is. It was something stupid, and I don't care. So he just shows up, and he's like, you understand both human strength and human weakness. Whatever that means. Move forward along the path of light. Do not waver. And then we see the rest of his group, which is now expanded beyond just Ultir's other time person, and has included the other members of the Oration Six, including Cobra. And they're walking about, and they all have their little things to say. But Urza continues... Oh, no, sorry, this is Gerard, who is now monologuing. He says, we will travel the path of darkness. However, you're...
Darkness!
Yeah, I fucking hate that line. I just, like...
Darkness!
I can't hear it without thinking fucking Kingdom Hearts. We will travel the path of darkness. However, your path may one day meet ours. When that happens, I want you to shine brightly enough to erase our dark selves. Which is weird, because none of them are acting even mildly kind of, like, mopey. Like, one of them's like, my clothes are tacky, and, like, fucking Cobra's just like, he thinks he's so cool, doesn't he?
Like, girl wearing the matching black robes, and, like, and the girls are just like, oh, God, these are so stupid.
Like, the one dude, the fucking dude with the square face, it's just like, how is this dude, how are you going to try to say this dude's walking the path of darkness? He's just like, love, is it not? Like, he was such a nice dude. He was literally, a magic power went through him to turn his evil into niceness. And he's still like, he's still going to try to be like, we all walk the path of shadow and darkness. He's just like, I don't, I saved a kitten today. You're like, no, we have to be more morally ambiguous than that.
It's okay, the other guy in the panel with him is making up for his act with his black eyeliner and lipstick.
Yeah, so you can be like, hmm. And then Garrard says, move forward, Urza. And Urza just, you know, mentally says, I'm not trembling anymore. So I don't know if the two of them had that conversation telepathically with one another or not. Because that'd be kind of weird, but it sounds like they did. We then cut away to Sabretooth, where we see the other members of Sabretooth. Welcome back, Sting, Rogue, and now Princess Minerva! She has come back to the guild, and she's crying because she's like, I'm home, and everyone's like, you've returned! Which is weird, because she was such a total bitch to everybody. You think some people, like...
Yeah, it's okay, though, because she's part of their guild.
Like, you think some people would be like, hey, it's good you're back, I hope you're still not a bitch. Like, they're all just like, it's our best friend, Minerva!
Maybe, like, they were getting ready to be like, oh, we're gonna tear that bitch new one. And then they saw that she was, like, sweating and had her head down, looked like she was about to cry, and she was like, hi, Minerva! Yay, you're back!
Oh, hey! I'm so glad Minerva's back. This is great. And, whew, I can't wait.
The one person in the back is like, she was such a bitch. Just, shut up, she's crying.
She's like, fucking, she's crying, dude. Don't be an asshole. And then my favorite part of this entire chapter happens. We cut away to the Rubble fairy tale again, where Dornbolt is talking to Makarov. And Dornbolt explains, like, I did what you wanted. I erased any memories of that from their minds. But I bet you expect me to erase my mind, too. But I don't want to tamper with my own memories. And Makarov says, you already have. You've done plenty. I absolve you from your duty. Dornbolt's like, what? And then Dornbolt's sleeve explodes open, and a fairy tale mark appears on his shoulder. And Makarov explains, you were a fairy tale wizard from the very start. You erased your own memories and infiltrated the council. And Dornbolt's like, what? And he's like, I told you, you're the kind of man who would sacrifice to protect the guild. And, you know, I told you not to erase your own memories, but you were so fired up you did it. But now you're back. And I'm just like, why? Who gave a fuck about Dornbolt? I forgot Dornbolt was a thing!
Maybe he's only been around for this arc.
No, he was back since the island arc, where they went to the island where they first met. Like, that was where he came in. He was supposed to be this member of the council that was gonna, you know, look over and make sure Fairy Tail wasn't doing awful shit. And he was an important character then. Then the time skip happened, and he's just been around.
Just kinda like hang around not doing it.
Yeah, he's just a thing that's there, and, like, every so often, like, he'll show up and be in a scene with Wendy, and I'm like, alright, I forgot, Dornbolt's still a thing. But I'm just like, who gave a fuck about Dornbolt that we needed this? Do you know how hard, like, there's so many characters in Fairy Tail. Like, I try to put an effort to give a fuck about the main characters in Fairy Tail. And then you'll have, like, your side cast, like, that isn't as, you know, it isn't, like, the main cast, like, Gajeel's girlfriend, I keep forgetting her name, Levy. Or, you know, Elfman, or Mira Jane, and Lasana. Like, those characters were, like, kind of secondary. You still kind of, like, try to give some kind of effort to give a fuck about them. Then there's, like, the tertiary characters, like, fucking the dad with Biska. Purple magic. Yeah, Biska, and Jet, and Dowry. And I'm like, you have all these characters I don't even try to give a fuck about. And you're like, I'm just gonna add Dornbolt to this. Just, while I read it, it was just like, who cares? No one gives a fuck about Dornbolt.
And why reveal this now? Because they've been back from their, you know, pseudo time skip thing for the tournament and this arc. What was the point of keeping the truth from him up until this point if he was just hanging around not doing anything?
Yeah, like, the whole notion was that he was supposed to be their contact within the council, which I can't...
Which he hasn't been doing since they got back from the stasis.
And that feels like such an easy answer, like, oh, we just, you know, you were a member who was secretly working for the council, you know, for us. But the Magic Council, supposedly, like, the strongest...
How convenient!
The strongest mages in the country were just like, we did not see this deception at all. Like, I guess he walked into a room and was just like, I know I'm a mage of fairy tale to you all right now, but I'm not anymore. Poof. And he just used their magic on him. And they're just like, oh shit, who are you, mysterious person? You should be our council member. I can understand, like, the idea that maybe there have been hints to this at some point. I can't say whether there are or not, because I've never given enough of a fuck about Dornvolt to care. Like, that's the thing. I sit here just like, who gives a fuck if Dornvolt joins Fairy Tail? When I saw it initially, I just laughed for like 5 straight minutes, to like, alone in my room, like just reading the chapter, I just started laughing until eventually it just devolved into like that Marge Simpson, like. Like, I couldn't grasp it. It was so amusing to me. Like, everyone has to have a happy ending. Even the characters no one cares about. Of course. No, go ahead.
It's bizarre. What's he gonna do now? Like, what's the point?
Well, Nick, it's interesting you say that, because they do this big thing of being like, you're a member of the guild, so they can immediately be like, Fairy Tail's disbanded.
Welcome to the guild, Dornbolt.
We're gone. You're our final member. We're closing now. We're all done. You get your free handbag out the door. Pick up a rock, pick up some rubble, and carry it home. It's yours to cherish forever. No, like, in the same two pages, he's like, you're a member, Fairy Tail, but doesn't matter now because it's all over and those kids are going to choose their own walk.
Now we're dissolving Fairy Tail.
Yeah, they're going to choose their own walk.
Question has got to be asked. Why?
Because everyone's doing their own thing, and by everyone,
you don't have to officially disband. You can just be like, "We're going on hiatus."
Well, what I find funny is like everyone's doing their own thing. Well, not everybody. I mean, Natsu, Lucy, and Gray are, but like those are the only characters.
But they're the only ones
that fucking matter. So, like, I like to think that Elfman's still like waiting outside. Like, when's the guild going to get back up and running? I'd like to go on missions.
He didn't get the memo.
Like, he's got like a backpack. And he's really excited. Like, I want to do a mission today. Sorry, Elfman, you're not popular enough for us to keep the guild running.
Everyone like walks away from Fairy Tail. And then eventually, like, a single, like, little pile of rubble gets pushed to the side, and, like, fucking, I don't know, Misgun, like, pops out, and he's like, where is everybody? Where'd you go? And it's like, we're gone. No one, like, told him he's, like, Milton or something like that. Just, like, still assumes the Fairy Tail is still operating, and everyone just like go like ignoring him whenever he asks questions.
It's such like a situation. You're just like, I guess you're gonna just take. It's almost like one of those like teenage tantrum things where it's just like Maria isn't gonna go on the vacation with us, so none of us are gonna go on the vacation at all. And you're just like, you have 3 people who can stay on, you know, have the vacation and enjoy it. I mean, you're already paying for it. What's the harm in, you know, still doing it? And just like, no! Natsu and Lucy and Gray aren't going to be here, so we're not going to have the guild.
What, those 3 kids who aren't even technically the strongest members?
Yes! I mean, we have Urza, and, you know, presumably Laxus will still hang around. I mean, he's going to get stronger, but, you know, nothing saying he's going to leave or anything like that. They're like, shut up!
Isn't Kana supposed to be like S rank now? No.
What? Who? The one who always wears the bikini top and gets drunk a lot? That's not enough of a defining fetish for me to remember which member of Fairy Tail this is.
Too many of them already wear bikini tops.
We then cut away to Lucy, who is outside of her apartment, and she's like, I know someone's in my apartment. It's gotta be Natsu and Happy. Will you get out? She opens the door, and no one's in there. And instead, there's a letter, and she reads it, and it says, me and Happy are going on a training journey. We'll be back in a year. Tell everybody I say hi and bye. Catch you later, Lucy. Signed, Natsu and Happy. And Lucy runs out into the street, you know, kind of crying and screaming out, like, taking off on a journey. What's he thinking? Doesn't he know how lonely I'll be, that dummy? And she's crying, and then we...
It's not like I like him or anything.
I know. But it's weird, like, for this series, which, like, I guess that's the relationship they're still pushing of Lucy and Natsu. Like, I just keep forgetting. Like, anytime I think of Natsu relationship, I always go back to, like, that one time they really heavily insinuated that Natsu had, like, a fucking thing for Lasana that just never was resolved. But yeah, that's pretty much exactly what happens.
Oh, yeah, like, once you've been around the girl and her weird cat fetish, eventually you're just like...
Oh, man. I mean, I love...
This is not nearly as hot as it was when I was, like, 12.
I love Tiger Print hot pants as much as the next guy, but, you know. This chick shows up in bikinis a lot, so... And she gets naked all the time. So much so it's actually kind of becoming mundane. So I found what I'm gonna hang after. But then we cut away to all of our different fairy tale members and, you know, Gray saying, I'm going to personally take N down. And I, Luvia, for some reason, gives, like, a reaffirming yes. I guess because Froge wasn't here for this scene to say to add nothing to the conversation at all. And then we see all of our other guild members, including Dorenbolt, just, like, staring and, like, fucking...
Oh, I can't believe this is happening!
Like, abject disbelief. Like, he's still like, I can't fathom how stupid this is. Like... I like to think he's just so baffled at this point. He's like, I'm a fairy tale guild member? Why? Like, how are you still this shocked by this? I like to think, like, 2 days later, he's still going to be staring wide-eyed in disbelief, like, oh my god. And then he kind of went in that, too.
Come back from the year of training, and he's still just like, I'm a fairy tale guild member?
Like, he keeps walking at the people and pointing towards his shoulders, like, did you know? Did you know?
They're like, no, you erased our memories, you idiot.
And you put Mr. Yuck stickers all over your photos inside the fucking guild, so we didn't know you were a member in all our class photos and shit. And then we cut away to Natsu. He's like, sorry, everyone, but I gotta get lots stronger before I come back. I gotta do it for you guys. And then we finally cut away to Seraph inside Fancy Place with the Book of End. And he's looking out a window and he says, go on. Try to surpass me, Natsu. Or should I say... Aetherius Natsu Dragnil.
E-N-D. End.
Your super Desu Desu name. Oh, so... Yes, Natsu is End, or has some connection to End of some kind, it seems.
And apparently Natsu is going off for a year. Does this mean this is a time skip that's happening again?
I guess so. Like...
And, like, for real this time, and, you know, yeah. Not just for all the characters that aren't important.
We definitely had this weird, like, halfway time skip before with the island, and then, it moved us forward essentially 7 years in the future. So, basically all the characters we knew didn't advance in those 7 years, but the rest of the world did, but honestly not a whole lot changed. And then after that, everyone had to do, like, this big training arc where most of them just got, like, an extra heart of power unlocked or something stupid like that. I forget the exact, like, logic behind it. It's like, you have an extra core of power you're not using. Let me just get that for you. Click! So, yeah, I guess this is now going to be, like, the proper time skip. And, you know, a year later, we'll see these characters and where they're at then. The chapter's funny just because, like, it's so... very distinctly fairy tale.
Yeah.
Like, just with its need of being like, here's where everyone is, and look, I grew my hair back, and look,
you were a member of fairy tale all along.
Yeah. And the obligatory Gerard walks by, Urza, I have feelings for you, but we're not going to be in a relationship because I walk the path of darkness. I walk the street alone.
Darkness! Bye.
Yeah, and I'll peace out, but my group's bigger, whatever. Like, it's such a fun chapter. Like, these are one fairy tales that it's, like, most amusing to me, just because they're so goofy. Like, I could seriously sit and just wax on, like, the ridiculousness of Dorenbolt joining fairy tale for, like, half an hour, because it's so insane to me and unnecessary, but it's fun. Like, it's not god-awful. I mean, it's stupid, as you said, Nick, when you described fairy tale. You're like, it's not bad. It's just very, very stupid. That's basically what this chapter is, where you're just like, I'm glad Wendy had that all-important haircut to grow her hair back after doing nothing.
Oh, God.
Oh, yeah. Good chapter, though.
All right, let's move on to Food Wars, Shokugeki no Soma, chapter 102, Soma's Strength. quote-unquote strength, by the way. Yeah. So, this chapter has a lot of narration and exposition by Ishiki. Part of it is like a flashback he has with Soma's father, but part of it is him continuing to call out Aizen on his bullshit. There's not a lot that happens at the start of the, in the very first page of the chapter. It was just him talking with Soma, and Soma's, and his father is just saying, it's like, oh, you know, there's all this stuff about Soma, you know, he sticks out like a sore thumb here and stuff. But then it cuts to him talking to Aizen, and he says, you know, have you seen this, you know, latest issue of the Totsuki Spotlight? You know, almost every article mentions Soma criticizes him one way or another. And in fact, according to the Journalism Club, the more they skewer Soma, the more copies they sell. And Aizen's just like, well, yeah, that's because everyone fucking hates Soma, because when he first got into the school, he said that the institute was going to be a stepping stone. So, of course, everyone's going to buy more if they hate him, if they bash him. And so Ishiki says, no, I don't think that that's all there is to it. But we briefly pause in this in order to see Soma's secret weapon for his dish, which is some kind of white broth. And Irina seems to recognize it before anyone else does. And so the judges are like, okay, yeah, we'll try it. Alice gets kind of upset because she thinks that he's just repeating the same thing that he did when they had their challenge with the bento boxes, and she continues to use her incredibly frustrating Valley Girl voice, which still really bugs me. It's just like the random uses of, like, I don't care about that. It's just totally a stupid rehash of a certain trick you tried before. That doesn't fit her character. It doesn't.
Next week in One Piece, Zoro is a fucking cowboy gangster. Like, well, y'all best come around here. Yeah, see, yeah. I'ma cut you up there, Pariko.
Cowboy, samurai, pirate.
Plus mafioso, add that in there.
So someone says, all right, everyone, dig in. And so the head of the academy digs into the new dish, and not only does he disrobe, but his clothing vaporizes off of him. It's affected him so much. And so he observes, ah, this white broth, this soy milk. And Soma goes into his, you know, explaining his dish monologue, and he says, I mixed a dash of Parmesan cheese and a little dollop of miso paste into the soy milk, blah, blah, blah. It's pike takikomi rice, Ojiya style. Ojiya, also called Zosui. Oh my god.
There's so much shit.
Like, the one drawback to doing Soma is there's all this random food explanation stuff, and I don't. All of it goes over my head.
Yeah, like, it was kind of interesting because, you know, this entire fish thing, I've just been like, I don't like fish, so, like, this is one of the few times a food manga can't make me hungry at all because I just know fish is gross. But then he's like, oh, and they mix soy milk with Parmesan cheese, and I'm, like, suddenly interested, and I'm, like, trying to read the explanation. I'm just like, I'm not going to do this. The closest I'm going to get to this is opening up a thing of Campbell's soup and like eating it with a glass of milk. Like, that's the closest I'm going to get to this, and I'm at peace with that, Nick.
So Irina says that, like all soups, the most important part of Ojiya porridge is the stock. He built this dish to be porridge from the start, with soy milk as the stock. Okay. So basically, the pipe that he presented to the judges before was very much an incomplete dish. This isn't just a little addition, this is like the very base of the dish itself, which is why the reason for the tremendous difference in how they feel about it. So, Tenzaimon says, oh, it's how interesting this is, and everyone is reacting to it, and while someone's explaining individual little facets of the dish, like, oh, these are crunchy pickled plum bits. And Leonora is launching into her long explanation about everything. And then we go back to Ishiki continuing to call out Aizen. So he says, you know, Soma challenged Chef Shinomiya, you know, the alumnus and former first seat to Shokugeki, and he survived. He went toe-to-toe with master fragrance manipulator Akira Hayama using a spice-centric dish. He beat Alice Nakiri, family to the gastric godfather himself, in the quarterfinal round. And in the semifinal, he ended Shokugeki B. Subaru Mimasaka, his first loss in 99 matches. But despite all that, most students don't want to give some of his due. Why is that, I wonder? And so we go to a flashback that I guess was related to Ishiki through Soma's father to a time when Soma was a little kid, and so he basically challenged his father and said, you know, Dad, I'm going to grow up to be an even better chef than you are. And so his dad just kind of dismissed this. He was like, yeah, to my eye, Soma never really had any outstanding talent for cooking. You know, I didn't press him to become a chef either. So I figured it was just a phase and it would pass once he lost to me a few times, but loss after loss, he didn't give up. He kept getting better and better, one small step at a time, and one day, it hit me. One thing that most normal people have, Soma was missing. People generally think, the other guy's a natural, of course I'm going to lose. Consciously or unconsciously, normal people put that lid on their feelings when they face off against a genius. They do it because they want to preserve what pride and self-confidence they have, you see. But Soma doesn't have that lid. Instead, he has the courage to stare straight at his own inadequacies. Even I didn't have that. That's an unbelievable strength. So, this is a really big kind of moment explaining Soma's awesomeness, essentially.
This is, a really cool character development bit.
Yeah. It's something that, you know, you can easily tell if you've read Shokugeki no Soma to this point, because his main characteristic has just been when anyone else would be cowed by something, he just is just like, okay, I'm just gonna go after it and I'm gonna do it. Even when he kind of dug himself into a hole by his own doing, he would just calmly analyze the situation and be like, okay, this is what I need to do in order to get out of this. Whenever he went up against some incredibly strict judge and people were like, oh my god, this is impossible, it's like, I'm just gonna do my best and I'm gonna put my dish towards them and I'm gonna pass this challenge. And so what Ishiki says is that Soma's, just mindset is that he's not incredibly naturally talented. He's just stubborn, and he keeps on plugging away through trial and error. And so that's something that anyone can do. And so if people were to acknowledge Soma's talents at this point, then they would have to also acknowledge their own shortcomings, because all he does is he refuses to give up and keeps on going after his challenges until he tackles them. And so anyone else who hasn't matched his level has to acknowledge, I could have done this, and I couldn't.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's an awesome trait, too, for a shonen protagonist, because a lot of times shonen protagonists kind of have their natural abilities sort of hereditary and gifted to them. And I just thought it was really cool for, his dad to even be like, he never really had an outstanding talent for it. I didn't.
Yeah, it's really a really big thing, because Soma's dad is already, incredibly known as being famous and talented and so on and so forth. So specifically for Soma to have a famous father and to have not inherited any of his typical traits and stuff is very, very big deal.
Yeah, and he even knows, I didn't even press him to become a chef either. I assumed it was just a phase. But as I said, it's the notion that he doesn't give up after these losses, and he's truly just becoming an elite-level talent solely through hard work and through something that we don't see a whole lot, losing. Through every time he faces a loss, he says, of course I was going to lose. That person's the natural, but I'll just get better, and I'll, face my inadequacies, and I'll improve upon them. And it's a great, sort of lesson to learn in that, and it's a really admirable trait in your protagonist.
So Ishiki says, open your ears and listen, Aizan, because that particular tie is about to turn. And people in the audience are like, oh man, he's pretty cool. Soma's pretty awesome. He might actually win. And one person says, Soma Yukihira is amazing. And then we cut to the judges again, and Leonor is enjoying the dish, and she has a flashback to when she met her husband, and they were dancing around in fields and being all lovey-dovey and stuff. And so then the headmaster declares that this is the end of the judging, and they will now make their decision. Soma takes off his headband and awaits judgment, basically.
Very good chapter. Again,
it's an awesome chapter.
Yeah, that kind of character development is something that's not often seen, and helps to really kind of cement Soma as one of the more likable and solid underdogs in the jump lineup.
There was something that happened. Let me see. There was one moment. Let me see if I can actually find it. When Ishiki is calling out Aizan on the coverage of Soma. He even says, here, just even look at this terrible picture. And he holds up the picture where they have the badass pose between Kurokiba and Hayama, and then there's just a little, like, insert of Soma. It's come up, like, 3 times now. And he's actually like, see, this was a deliberate measure. That's why it's such an unflattering picture for him.
And you do have to kind of like what that's saying now, wearing that, you know, now the rest of the student council's kind of, or the rest of the student body's kind of having to accept him at this point because he might become part of their, you know, 10, whatever they call it, the student council or 10 student judges, whatever the fuck that position is.
Elite 10 council.
There you go. So yeah, really good chapter of Shogeki. And I've mentioned a couple times that I'm going to try to catch up. That's one of my goals for like the next week. I'm going to try to get a good portion of Shokugeki no Soma under my belt so I can be fully caught up on that.
So, let's move on to Gakyu Hote.
Yes.
Chapter 6, The Shuichi Higashide Cheating Case, Part 2. This opens up with a little like monologue by Ibaku addressing the audience and saying, you know, the current case is you know, it's a case of where something even beneficial like medicine could be misused, and it's just like this case is just like that with the Kiaim of the erasable marker, which, you know, very different from medicine, but whatever. So, of course, just to briefly recap, Shuichi Higashide was accused of cheating using an erasable marker. I guess the running thought is that he forgot to erase his cheating stuff after he wrote everything in the desk. So, the judge... It's so weird, because, like, old man judge baby is a baby, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he's clearly on his feet walking around the desk, too.
And he doesn't look, like, that small, either. Like, you'd think, like...
He's taller than the desk.
Yeah, you'd think that if he was, like, a preschooler, he'd be about the size of the desk or something like that. Or maybe...
I think these aren't actually babies, but are mutants, grown for the explicit purpose of judging these cases.
And that, you know what? It sounds insane, but based off of what we see at the end of this chapter, it's not an impossibility.
So, the judge is just like, oh, it seems like, yes, writing this many kanji without being discovered will be difficult, so the perpetrator likely prepared this when he or she was alone in the classroom, and the accused had the opportunity after school the previous day, and so Ibaku objects and says, well, he or she had, you know, a task, and that's why he was in class, not to commit a crime, and so Pine says, objection! Because there were no witnesses, it's possible that the accused committed the crime even when he was supposed to be doing that other stuff, so... And the judge is like, yeah, so we can't just deny the possibility, basically. Mm-hmm. But Ibaku remains confident, even though Pine's like, ha! My objection was the one that won in this particular exchange!
I won one battle of a war! I'm the greatest!
So, the judge calls for the witnesses to be called up. Pine calls up Nakayama and Asa, who, at one point share the podium. It's weird.
Yeah, I mean, you don't see that very often, but you know, that's their wacky character trait. Like, there's plenty of weirdos in Phoenix, right? I mean, they've had a kid and a parrot take the stand before, so this is just the one time they're gonna have two people take the stand.
So they basically go over all the stuff that you would expect them to, saying, oh yeah, you know, I'll bet it was this or this happened. I'll bet this happened. And Tento's like, oh, they're accusing he actually of cheating. And Ibaka's like, stop it. You're pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
You're such a mark. So the judge calls for a cross-examination, and Ibaku says, all right, there were other chances to be alone in the classroom. For example, the morning on the day of the test, if you arrived early, you had plenty of time to do this, and Nakayama was the first one there this morning. But Nakayama says, ah, yes, but Higashide would have noticed if I had drawn it inside of his desk during the test, because everyone has to put everything in their desk. He would have noticed the writing if it had happened beforehand, and he was not the person to have written it down. And so... Ibaku says, oh, what do you have to say about that, Higashide? And so he says, I would never violate the rules, so if I had seen such a thing, I would have mentioned it on the spot. So, obviously, you know, it's like, oh, well, that just means that you wrote it, and of course you didn't bring it up. So then Abaka says, but there was also another opportunity, which would have been during PE. Somebody could have, you know, dashed from the field, lied about going to the bathroom, gone to the classroom and, you know, drawn everything inside the desk. And the only two who took toilet breaks during phys ed are Asa and Nakayama. And it's at this moment that I notice that Asa is wearing a Mega Milk sweatshirt.
Yes. I don't know what Mega Milk is.
It's some sort of... It's a meme, which I think has roots in... Well, I mean, you're going to be shocked to hear this. A hentai doujinshi.
Okay.
Yeah, amazingly. Yeah. So, yeah. It... Yeah.
I think it's curious that she's wearing it then.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what she's just stating openly. Like, that's what I'm into. I'm a sixth grader. Yeah,
I go on the 2chan.
Yeah. I love doujinshi. Whatever the fuck you call it.
Doujinshi.
I love my anime porn. And, fucking I'm proud of it. Mm. I'm loud and proud. Dig it.
So, Abaka says, okay, you know, it could have been Asa who did this because, you know, Asa was gone for 10 minutes and Nakayama was gone for about 5 minutes. So Asa's like, no, I just went to the bathroom. I had... And so Abaka says, I know it wasn't you because if you, you know, were to use the third floor bathroom, you'd have to go up and down stairs too. And given that it's Asa we're talking about, it wouldn't be odd to say she might take 5 minutes longer than other students. And they're like, oh, but still... And Abaka says, I was also convinced from the get-go Asa is definitely not the perp. Because look at this desk. The characters are written so far back that even Tento, who has a small build, had to work hard to reproduce it. Asa's arm is just too chubby to stick in and write letters inside the back of the desk.
He's such an asshole. Like, because he even says, like, she's definitely not the perp. And Asa's, like, kind of, like, love-struck for a moment. She's like, oh, you trust me? Does that mean? And it's just so he can be like, eh, fatty with the big fat arms can't get in the desk. Fatty, fat, fat, fat.
So Abaka.
So then she's like stomps off because he's like, alright, you can go now.
But by process of elimination, Nakayama remains on the witness stand. Or rather, shall I call it the execution stand? Nakayama, are you not the true perpetrator who tried to frame Higashide? And Nakayama's like, hey, what the heck? That's not funny. I was only gone to use the bathroom for 5 minutes during phys ed, and that's way too short a time to write everything down inside the desk. And the buck was like, yes, I tested it too. If you take 2 minutes to run each way from the field to the classroom, it would still need about 5 minutes to write all those kanji inside the desk, so that's definitely way too short a time for you to have done it then. And so Nakayama was like, yes, that's right, there's no way I could have done it. Ah, but if you had done it in the morning before everyone else, you could have done it and then switched the desks when you went from the field during PE. And so Pine is trying to raise objections and so on and so forth, and Abaka's like, yes, well, you know, the desk that Higashide was sitting at wouldn't have had any writing during the test, but then she would have switched the desk afterwards, and then during the discovery, the one that was in Higashide's place would have had writing inside of it. So Inugami's like, oh, really? Come on. The teacher was walking around during the test, and she would have noticed that the nameplate sticker would have been different because it's very clearly visible. So Abaka's like, ah, but look, erasable markers and erasable correction pens. She used the erasable marker to make Nakayama into Higashide and the erasable correction pen to turn Higashide to Nakayama.
What? Whoa, that's cray cray, Nick.
So presumably, I guess the erasable correction pen is like erasable whiteout, I guess?
Something like that, yeah.
So, basically, Abaka says, you know, during the second period phys ed, Nakayama faked a bathroom trip to go to the classroom instead. She applied an eraser to both nameplate stickers, returned them to the correct names, put the desk back in their original spots, and completed her scheme, switching out the contents of the desk too, of course. And that is how Higashide's desk instantaneously became a cheat sheet. 1 minute may be too short for writing kanji, but not for this, eh? And even adding in 4 more for the round trip still makes it only 5 minutes. This is the truth behind Nakayama's 5-minute gap during phys ed when she was MIA.
What?
I don't know, erasing stuff off of desks and, like, switching them around and stuff. I don't know if you could do that in 1 minute. That seems like you have to be, like, really booking it.
I guess if you've planned it, if it's premeditated, maybe.
Maybe if she'd had time to practice in the morning.
Yeah.
So Nakayama is like, just because, you know, you can convert my name to Higashi because Japanese, even though the names look way different to us anglicized folk, just because they're easy to, you know, convert, that's just a coincidence. You don't have any proof. And Aruka's like, no. Just like with Asa, there's actually something that definitively rules Higashide out as the perp. Did you happen to notice it, Judge? Of all the words written inside this desk, only the kanji for shadow is wrong. I suspect the perpetrator copied it incorrectly by mistake. Thus, there's no way Higashide, who got a perfect score that day, could be the perp. Conversely, the perp who took the test sitting at this desk would logically get just this one answer wrong. You said you missed scoring 100 due to a stupid mistake, but if that one careless error was the kanji for shadow, you'll acknowledge your crime, right? So, they call up for her test answer sheet to be presented to confirm this, but Nakayama realizes she's been caught and says, yes, it's just as Inugami said, I did it. So, she's like, it's just because he's so perfect all around, it's not fair, and Naibaku's like, you've got it wrong, Nakayama. Look, this is Higashide's drill book. Look at how filled out it is. That's because he's not perfect. It's because he studies so hard among everyone. That's why he got the perfect score. Even in shining Higashide's shadow, which might be hard to see through the glare, lies humble, plain effort. Just like how the sun, merely bright when looked at directly, is burning away its life internally every single second. So does Baku like him now? So the baby judge pronounces his judgment, saying that Higashi is innocent, and that Nakayama must fill out 100 pages of a 100-square lesson book with a kanji for effort.
What? That's mean.
Which is like filling out an entire blackboard, I think, basically. Maybe more. So Higashi approaches Ibaku and extends his hand, and Ibaku slaps his hand.
Oh, no, sorry. I thought it was like slapped it away. Slap and like,
five kind of thing.
I thought it was like heel move in a wrestling where you're just like, I slap your hand because I don't respect you.
Like kick it away.
Yeah.
So Tento is like, afterwards, Tento is kind of grinning at Bakugan. He's like, why are you looking all creepy? And Tento says, oh yeah, I was just thinking that you acknowledge Higashide too, Inugami. And Bakugan says, no, it's just that no matter who you are, shouldn't be convicted of a crime you didn't commit. That's what classroom arbitration is for. And he has a flashback to being in prison. Yay!
Darkness.
At that moment, Tento senses somebody glaring at them from behind and looks over his shoulder, but he doesn't see anyone. He's like, I felt someone watching us. And Bug's like, you just live worried about what's going on around you. You should copy me, not care about anyone. Because I'm an asshole.
Suck it. Fatty Fat. What? Someone tell Fatty Fat 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 she's off the hook.
But then Higashide says from around the corner, yeah, I'm good. I got caught in an unforeseen situation, but he didn't catch on to my identity. I'll continue abiding by the organization's rules. And he's talking to someone on a cell phone while holding up a picture with Ibaku's face on it. And he gets a little caption that says, Shuichi Higashide, sixth grader, occupation, marks.
He's a spy!
He's like, puts on like sunglasses too.
I love having the music in the background because there's certain tracks for Phoenix Wright that just fit so well with these moments. Like the suspense track at this moment's just like, it's just a perfect fit where it's like, you know, with fucking. Yeah, eternity. Oh, he's a fucking spy of some kind! No!
Of some kind!
But yeah, the fact that there's sixth grade, like, super spies in this world makes me think it's not impossible for the judges to be some kind of mutant babies of some fashion.
Yeah. Considering that they have, you know, entire prison schools. Yeah.
Yeah. Alright, so let's real quickly get through High Fly Cluster.
I keep on forgetting about that thing.
I know. Well, you don't have to worry. I think next week's the last one. So High Fly Cluster, Chapter 17, As For Me, ... So, last week, a big explosion took place, and we didn't know if anyone survived. But shocker, Nick, everyone survived. Except Except maybe these, like, police dudes, but they weren't important, so nobody gives a fuck. Nice. So everyone's like, oh, I can't believe what happened! And we see Noto, and he's like, he got, like, a piece of his blade jammed through his leg, and he's laying there, and then all of a sudden a column starts to fall. But then Kondera shows up and grabs him and takes him away. And Noto's like, why'd you do that? You're not my boss anymore. And Kondera's like, oh, what, is that all the thanks I get for saving you? You know, it's over if you die, no matter who you are. Noto's like, you lame and suck. Never change. So they basically end on some kind of happy note. Like, it looks like he's forgiven him, despite the fact Noto killed, like, a whole bunch of innocent people, and doesn't actually seem sorry for that aspect of it. But whatever. We then cut away to Peta, who is, kind of... He has survived. He, you know, I know you were worried, Nick, that...
I wasn't.
Yeah, okay, well... I'm gonna say, I'm gonna act like you had surprise and fear about this. You were really worried. And the Alfred Nobel girl's fine, and I guess they have some label they could put over hers to make it so she won't blow things up all of a sudden. And they're like, hey, what happened to the landscape mall? And then we see him, and he's on the ground, and he's a little bit bloody. I guess, you know, that's what happens when you're caught in an explosion. Like, your ribs get a little hurt and burned. But the rest of you's fine. And he's just like, how lame! This series was so lame! No, he's actually saying it was stupid to approach them right away to take them out. A direct hit. I don't have any strength left. Who thought it would come to this? And then Kondera shows up, and he's, like, trying to arrest him. And then the landscape mole, like, does this little hand force wave push thing, and it destroys Kandera's prosthetic arm. And then Kondera just punches him. And landscape mole sees that inside of Kandera's prosthetic arm was a label, and they realize that Kondera all this time wasn't a hi-fi loader, but he's been modifying his body to make him able to do so at great stress to himself. And everyone's like, what? This is such a shock that we would have probably revealed a lot later had the series not been canceled. But Kondera has his big moment where he's like, it's what an ability is. What good is being chosen by ability if you're the one that ends up being used by it? Which is, like, a level of fucking meta philosophy I can't quite grasp. Like the notion that an ability is using you. Like, I'm really good at basketball. Are you good at basketball? Or is basketball good at you? And then you just sit there for a couple hours pondering the meaning of life. Anyway, they arrest Landscape Mole. And then they're like, shit happened. And then Petra's like, I didn't understand the need to a cover-up. But the days went back to normal. As for me, ... chapter end, because next week's the last chapter and I explain what happened. And that's the chapter. Mm-hmm. It's not going out like Stealth Symphony, Nick. It's not going out by killing half of its cast.
Stealth Symphony only killed one
person. Oh, yeah, I guess it only killed one person. It was just, it felt darker than that.
Yes. Alright. One Piece. Chapter 773. Half and half.
Mm-hmm.
So, last time, Cavendish kind of became all sleepy, kill-everyone personality, and he took out Dellinger along with almost all the combatants in the area where he, Bartolomeo, and Robin were. And so Bartolomeo reacts to this from the safety behind his barrier by going like, oh, he looks like Cabbage, but his face is all different, and he took down that kid with the horns and all the enemy soldiers! Except for Gladius, who's just like, no, Dellinger! As he goes, bleh, boom, So, Bartolomeo remembers, oh yeah, this happened in Block D of the Colosseum, so I guess that was him. Hmm, the clothes are obviously Cavendish, but the face belongs to someone else, Dish. So, tell me, whoven Dish is that?
Imagine that was a little, translation creativity there, but I kind of love the nose to death thing that that's his way of speaking, like, whoven Dish is that?
So Cavendish tries to get at Bartolomeo, but he's safe behind his barrier, and Bartolomeo's like, oh god, he's so scary! So Bartolomeo's like, hey, stop coming around, or else! And then Cavendish looks up and sees Robin trotting up the hillside, and he's like, hey, don't get any funny ideas now, but Cavendish runs up the mountainside to go after Robin, as Bartolomeo's like, no, don't get her, no. But Robin just grabs her with her binding many hands thing, and she says, "Your speed is useless against me. Did you want something, cabbage?"
Aww. I guess that's Robin's thing. She just, like, calls people by nicknames and shit. She's like, "I can't remember your name, but it sounded kind of like this, or you remind me a bit like this, so that's what you are now."
Well, everyone seems to call Cavendish Cabbage, so...
Well, everyone also calls...
Like Luffy does it, Bartolomeo does it, so...
Well, everyone calls Bartolomeo Rooster, so I guess it's just a thing. That's, like, their gimmick. They're Rooster and Cabbage. Wacky time cops who patrol the universe.
Time cops?
Yes. I made shit more elaborate in my head. They're out to stop that mutant baby judge program that creates those monsters that go to schools.
So, Bartolomeo fanboys because Robin so easily took care of the charging Cavendish, and at that moment Cavendish regains control of his body, and he's like, "Oh, Hakuba, I never authorized you to show your face," and he snaps back to normal. And so he's like, "Ah, I nearly cut you in two, Nigga Robin." "Oh, thank you." So Robin's like, "Ah, that was the oft-rumored Hakuba, a sleepwalking personality." He's like, "Yes, that's right. And he's a horrid parasite. He just slashes without discrimination or thought. Erk!" And then Hakuba goes, "I'll kill you in a pew, kill you, Nigga Robin. Bah, 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 bah." And it keeps on snapping back and forth between Cavendish being in control and Hakuba being in control. And they have a lot of, like, Cavendish saying, like, this is my fight. And Hakuba's saying, "No, I'll kill everyone." And then he's like, "I'll do it. No me. I will. No me. No me. No me. No me." And then eventually it's like half his face is Cavendish and half his face is Hakuba as he's going, "Me will do it."
That's pretty amusing.
Hence we get the half and half joke. But yeah, it's weird. But Cavendish briefly regains full control of his body, but he's like, "Okay, yes, you can let me go, Nico Robin." And so he's like, how the fuck am I supposed to trust you after all that happened? So she refuses to let him go, but then suddenly the entire cliffside starts to swell outward as Gladius starts to use his popping powers on the landscape itself. So Bartolomeo's like, "Oh, I've got to stop him." As he charges forward, Gladius uses his popping hair in order to spear Bartolomeo's leg because he's charging forward to attack him, and so he doesn't protect himself. And he's like, "Ah, those hairs are poison quills!" And so Bartolomeo's legs are starting to go numb, and he can't stop the wall from popping. And just in case, though, he turns his entire body into this giant swelling thing. He says, "If you aggravate my body, I'll burst and send thousands more of those poison quills at the two above us. But on the other hand, if you don't defeat me, you can't prevent the wall from exploding. So what's your choice? Of course, my blast is strong enough that you'll be dead as well. In either case, the attack's gonna hit Miss Robin." So Bartolomeo has a tremendous crisis of thought. He's like, "Oh, what am I gonna do? What's the top priority? All right, I've gotta protect Miss Robin. I've gotta stop the wall from blowing up. I've got to defeat this hedgehog! But if I do that, she'll be assaulted by the poison quills! Well, wait a second. Cabbage is up there, and I don't mind if he dies."
I love this thought process. "Wait a second. There's a guy next to her. I don't mind being dead. Hey, Cabbage! Can you take this lethal attack for Robin? Okay, thanks!"
But unfortunately, Hakuba's in control. He's like, "Shut up, Rooster." He's like, "Oh no, I can't count on him to throw his body in the way. Alright, I've got to stop him. Okay, there's only one way to ensure the needles don't go flying. The tricky part is my barrier only works in one solid piece at once, but oh well. Barrier ball!" And he summons a giant barrier bubble around himself and Gladius as he leaps forward with like a shiv to attack him. He's like, "Go ahead and burst, because you won't reach them." And Gladius is like, "Oh, how dare you!" And so he stabs and he thinks he's got Gladius in the windpipe as Gladius explodes and Bartolomeo gets fucking wrecked, basically.
Nick! Bartolomeo made a huge heroic sacrifice!
Nobody dies in one piece, shut up. So, except Ace and Whitebeard, but shut up. So, like, Bartolomeo's coat gets torn to shreds and he falls to the ground and he thinks to himself, "Ha! In your face, hedgehog. Now the wall won't blow." But it's still going as Gladius recovers and he says, "Too bad, you fool. You missed by inches. You didn't stab my windpipe, you just stabbed my shoulder." And Bartolomeo's like, "Ah, he was so puffed up I couldn't even tell the two of them apart, and I can't stop him from bursting the wall." And Gladius apparently isn't. All of his hair got popped off, too.
Yeah, he did that before at one point. He got so angry all of his hair exploded off and he had to, like, grow it back.
Huh.
It was a joke at one point.
So, he says, "You can't stop the wall from bursting. Watch and witness your friends being blown to bits." And, so, Gary is like, "I'm sorry, Nico Robin. I've got Hakuba under control." As his face is still half Hakuba. So Hakuba is like, "Oh, let go of me, I'll kill you." But Kaoru says, "Look, I'm leaving him half exposed. I'm in control, but I can use Hakuba's speed to get you to the flower field. It's the only way. Unhand me! Unhand me!" So Gladius reaches out and tries to pop the entire wall. But Cavendish has rushed them both to safety, so he's fine. They're both fine, rather. Also, Bartolomeo and Gladius are still behind the bubble shield, so they're safe from the cliff exploding over them, too. But all the other people are buried, and they're dead.
Mm-hmm. Who cared about them? Fuck Dellinger.
There's even a bit of a moment where, Cavendish is, like, trying to stab Robin, but he's grabbing onto the blade with his other hand to stop it. And then, as they kind of, like, leap up onto the cliff, he finally passes out, so Robin's just safe from him, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So Gladius is like, how could anyone escape that blast? So Bartolomeo thinks to himself, "I'm sorry, Mr. Luffy," as he goes, "Omad, Holy Fist, Barrier, Barrier!" And he continues the narration to himself, "I might not be that much for now, but I'm going to learn to be way stronger, and one day, I'm going to be worthy of helping you," as he does his own version of Luffy's jet pistol with Barrier, Barrier pistol, summoning a barrier around his fist and punching the fuck out of Gladius' head to knock him out.
Such an awesome fucking scene. Like, holy shit, that's cool. I love this notion of just, like, you know, he's such a fanboy, but he's actually homaging his abilities, you know, with Luffy's most basic attack of the pistol. But he's like, "I know I'm not much for now, but I'm gonna get stronger so that I can be used to you." It's fucking a great moment. You see him crying. There's a lot of emotion behind Bartolomeo, and he really is a compelling character. It's fucking good shit right there.
So Bartolomeo thinks to himself, like, "I'm never gonna fucking team up with that pain in the neck again," as it kind of pans over to Cavendish being passed out still. So, on top of the Flower Hill, the fourth step, Diamante is still messing up with Kairos and Rebecca, and so, you know, he's like, "Oh, you can't keep your feet. Even with two legs, you'd have trouble, but with one leg, it's basically impossible, right, Rebecca?" As he lashes out with his sword to try and attack her, but Robin arrives in the nick of time and summons a whole bunch of butterfly-making hands in the air that act as shields. Her powers are very weird.
He's left the chat, unfortunately. Oh, no, yes, he's still here. Gailson posted a link that basically she's making a whole bunch of Wu-Tang Clan symbols.
And, it's like how you make butterflies with your hands. It's all.
I just like the note that the notion that Robin's like a hardcore gangster rap fan. And she's just like, "You know, cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the dollar bill, y'all." And then someone's like, "I don't even think that's a fucking Wu-Tang song." And she's just like, "Shut up." And she pimp slap you, because she can from anywhere.
That's a good point. So everyone's like, "Oh, it's Robin." And so Robin says, "Your mission is complete, Rebecca. Thank you for delivering the key. Now it's my turn to protect you." And Rebecca's just like, "God damn it." Wanted to fight. Fuck all of you.
I think this is an awesome chapter in a lot of ways. You know, we get a little bit more of the stuff with Cavendish and Hakuba, which is fine. It's just, you know, Cavendish isn't particularly my favorite character, so it doesn't do a whole lot for me.
Bartolomeo is.
But Bartolomeo is, and this is a great chapter for him. You know, I love what we've seen and how his powers work and, you know, the intricacies of them. You know, I like that he creates that big barrier to make that big sacrifice. It's just a straw hat, you know, One Piece character style move of, like, "I'm going to sacrifice myself and take this attack so that I can help you." And I love that he has this moment at the end where he's like, "I'm not strong right now, and I know that, but I'm going to learn to be stronger because one day I'm going to help you." And I think it's such a fucking awesome moment. I know I've been, you know, as a half-jokingly, half-super-serious, like, Bartolomeo for Straw Hat, and if he doesn't join, I think that's, you know, that's fine. It seems very clear to me right now, though, that this is a character that will have an impact down the line in at least some fashion. they're planning something with this. He's going to be a big deal. And I love it. I think he's a really fun character. He's entertaining. I think his power is really well utilized. It's interesting to see the way it works and where it can evolve into. I just absolutely fucking love that his, you know, ability here is to basically mimic Luffy's trademark attack. I think that's fucking such a great little touch. And I really like the way this chapter ends, where we get to see that Robin's going to be presumably the one that's actually going to take down Diamante. I think that's a really cool development. I mean, we haven't seen Robin really fight anyone since she fought that big fat dude back in Skypiea. I mean, she was a prisoner for all the CP9 arcs. She kind of had like that half fight with Hogback and Chopper back in Thriller Bark, but that wasn't like a full-on battle my kind. Never since then, she just hasn't really done anything. I mean, even during
She's been part of team fights.
Yeah, and even during the Fishman, New Fishman Pirates arc, she was one of the few people that didn't actually fight anybody with her new ability. She just beat up some slave dude. Some dude was like, "I have a bunch of slaves," and she like punched him with like a bunch of hands. And you're like, oh, okay, man, it'd be cooler if you were taking out someone important. So I think it's really cool that Robin's gonna get not only a fight, but a fight presumably against one of the three strongest members of Don Quixote's clan. I think that's really awesome, and it really kind of established. I mean, she's fighting an opponent who's presumably on a very similar level to who Zoro's fighting, and I think that's awesome.
Right. So Zoro's going up against Topeka, and Treadbull is with Law and Luffy, so Robin, yeah.
Yeah, so
That's basically the three strongest people in the Straw Hats who are currently there.
So. Yeah, and we'll still presumably get to see Senor Pink versus Frankie. I can't wait for that. But I really dug this. I really like the implication we get here at the end. I'd love to see more of Robin's powers and how they work. As you said, they're kind of a weird thing, but I think she's a character that definitely deserves to have a cool moment, and this would be a good place for her to have it. I really love the Bartolomeo stuff. The Cavendish stuff works too. And just all overall, just a really solid One Piece chapter. Really, really dug it. I guess... We're on
Toriko.
Seven Deadly Sins real quick.
Damn it.
Sorry. Toriko. Sorry, Nick. I'll try to make it quick. Chapter 111, The Man Has His Say. And if that sounds like a very macho, douchey fucking title, don't worry, because this chapter is everything you could want in that category. The cover page is Melodious against Bond's back, and quote saying, "They're not supposed to be comrades anymore, but for some reason, they sometimes have this dream," which is a little bit, you know. I'm just saying, the Yaoi fanfics are being written already. So we start in the fairy forest with Jericho saying, I guess King is saying, like, "How long are you going to stay here?" to Jericho. And she's like, "What, you got a problem with that?" He's like, "Yeah, you're an unwelcome guest here." She's like, "Yeah, so are you, you fucking highness." And he's like, "Touche, you win that round, fucking Jericho. That's a good burn." And Jericho responds, "I'll leave when Bond leaves." So King says, "Do you have a thing for Bond?" She's like, "What? No, I don't. I don't have a thing for him. I'm just going to tag after him until he starts caring about me. I've got a far better chance than some dead little fairy girl." You're like, "All right, hold on, Jericho. I need to dissect the stupidity of your comment. One, the only reason you have feelings for Bond is because he rescued you from being a demon, and when he did so, you were naked. So you had that weird, someone seen me naked, I need to marry him mentality, which is sort of fucked up. And that's like her motivation now. She's like, "I'm just going to keep following after this dude who doesn't like me until he starts liking me."
That's like a very old school, like, preservation of purity type of thing.
It's not a good mindset.
It's very archaic. It's something along those lines of, like, the kind of thing where it's like, you know, a girl thinks that she's spoiled for marriage if she's corrupted in any way, shape, or form. So because of that, like, the person who has corrupted me by seeing me naked, has to be my husband.
Yeah, well, it gets a little bit worse in just a moment, and I'll tell you why. But I just want to get to her other quote. "I've got a far better chance than some dead fairy girl." It's such a douchey, fucking bitchy comment. Why would you say that? Like, "I know he has the hots for some girl who's dead, but I'm alive, so he has to love me." Like, well, that's just a cold thing. So, of course, the next page, Bond's behind her, and he's like, "As if." And then he says, "I'll strip you," which is a weird comment. And then we just see, like, the forest, like, sky with the sound effect of flip. And the next panel, she's been stripped. So Bond was like, I don't like your comment, so I'm going to take off all of your clothes again. And as she's screaming, I swear I'm going to make you take responsibility for this, King's just like, you keep doing that so often, I'm actually getting used to it. And I'm like, what a horribly awkward scene. Why is this Bond's thing now? Like, he just keeps taking off women's clothes he doesn't like? I don't know about you, it's not an endearing character trait. This makes you out to be a jerk. Mm. But anyway, Bond explains that he doesn't have the hots for her, and he's going to keep doing his business and find a way to bring Elaine back from the dead. And you guys can leave as soon as you want, but I'm going to be staying here. But I won't kick you guys out, because I'm not an asshole. I mean, I'll strip people for no reason, but I'm not a super asshole, I guess. So both of them are kind of just like, well, I'm not leaving yet. This fucking Jericho's putting on her goddamn underwear. It's such a stupid moment. Why? Like, it's just such a weird thing for Bond's character trait to be like, I'm going to strip you because you're fucking annoying me. But Bond and King start having a fight, and King's like, you know, why don't you go ask Merlin about what she can do? And the captain, go back to them. And Bond's like, I don't want to go back to Seven Deadly Sins. And, you know, King's like, you need to make up with him. The captain's supposed to be your friend. I know a lot's happened, but I'm sure I'll forgive you. And Bond replies with, that's why I hate him so much. Or that's what I hate so much. And Bond's like, if you got enough time to be fussing over me, you better go back to the Boris hat, because Diane's saying, I die of loneliness if King ever left. And, you know, that was something that Bond had used previously to kind of trick King. So King's like, I'm not falling for that again. He's like, no, this time it actually did happen, so you better go home. And he does. He starts flying home. And we cut away to Gowther and Merlin. And Gowther is eating this strange medicine that Merlin's like, keep taking one of these every day, and your armor will be back in no time. And then some hijinks happen. Gowther leaves, and he throws the pills immediately away. He has this conversation with Melodius. Then he meets up with Giulia, and they're like, all right, we're going to head off. And they're kind of acting a little bit strange. I'm just going to blow through the rest of this. This is a long chapter, I didn't realize. We find out that the 10 demons who were resurrected before are the elite unit that works directly under the Demon King, a.k.a. the 10 Commandments, which makes Merlin flare up with their power. Then we cut away to Gowther and Giulia, who are hanging about, doing, like, romantic stuff under a tree. When Giulia's sister, or little brother, shows up and tries to talk to her, Gowther threatens him with lightning at the end of the chapter that seems to suggest maybe this isn't Gowther anymore, or maybe he has some sort of demonic presence in him, because it's certainly not very heroic to try to threaten a child with lightning bolt death magic. But then again, after seeing how Bond's acted this chapter, I wouldn't be entirely surprised this is how the Seven Deadly Sins are. And anyway, that's the chapter. It was pretty bad.
Okay. Alright, Toriko. Toriko Gourmet. What number was he guys on? 300?
It doesn't show up until like the very end. It was a very bleach-like chapter.
Gourmet 308. Full power stride. Okay, so we cut to a bunch of different locations in this chapter to kind of show the state of the world after, you know, air and a whole bunch of other gourmet world ingredients were brought back by the Octomelon. And so, you know, there's all people like, oh, this is wonderful food, yay! We see the IGO headquarters where Mansum is trying out air, and the beast inside him has caused his arm to get all, you know, gourmet celled up for a bit. Rin freaks out over news from Toriko, because that's Rin's entire character, unfortunately. She, funnily enough, is asking, like, Zange about it, and Zange's like, why are you asking me? She's like, I thought you were a resident goblin. And he's like, and so, like, what is his name?
Daruma.
The Daruma's like, oh, you look like one of us. I'm a human. It pleases me to know that our brethren can be found in the human world, too. I'm Zange, the mightiest gourmet hunter of the world. Remember me? And everyone's just ignoring him.
Well, it's worth noting that this whole thing happens because after Mansum eats the salad, he's just like, I wonder if the others who went to the gourmet world in support of Toriko may also have something activate inside of them from eating this sort of food. You know, something might awaken in them from eating salad or other, you know, parts of Acacia's full course menu. And, you know, they show, like, Zange, Match, Chin, Live Bear, all those kinds of characters. And I thought that was a cool moment to be like, hey, you know, we introduced these characters. Some of them you grew to like. Some of them you still know who the fuck they are. But some of them you do like. So there's a chance that these characters can still show up because, you know, they may not have been strong enough then, but eating this food might make them strong enough to survive there. So I thought, you know, that was the idea, saying, hey, these characters might show up. I didn't realize that group of characters are literally traveling in a group to the gourmet world. Like, it might as well be a group just called the side characters, because it's all of them in one group. I'm like, how the fuck did Zanga even get in this group?
Like, how are you surviving this thing? He's just like, why wouldn't I?
I want to fucking see, like, the bus trip that got them to this point, where Match is sitting next to Zange, and he's just like, how the fuck did this happen? Who are you?
He's just like, who are you? I am Match. I'm the head of the gourmet mafia. And who are you? I am Zange, the greatest gourmet hunter in the world. Ah, ha, ha.
He's like, you're a goddamn idiot. This is fucking bullshit.
Tintin asks, like, oh, where's Brunch? And so Dharma says, he is making his way to Gourmet Corps. And so we cut to Brunch, who's got, you know, bag of greens over his shoulder, lightninging up this mountain, which is called Mount Sea because it's a volcano made out of ocean.
Which is kind of awesome in a way I can't explain.
So he's thinking, I wonder if it's okay, because, you know, Torko, you asked me to bring air to Midora. Why would you do that? So he reaches the, you know, whatever it's called.
Opening the summit.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Let's just call it that. I know there's a term for it, but he's like, oh, here it is, Gourmet Corps' new hideout. So he dives inside, and he's like, you know, I hope that, you know, I'm gonna make it back home alive, because I'm gonna be facing the strongest man in the world. Zap. And then we cut to the dining planet, where there are a whole bunch of nitros with weird haircuts talking with Froze. Joey.
Yeah. I like to think that out there there's a Nitro fashion channel, and it's just like, you know, like fucking Nitro Joan Rivers, who's just like, you know, Joan Rivers, rest in peace, but Nitro Joan Rivers, who's just like, pompadours and mohawks are in this season!
The first one we see looks like he's like halfway to a flock of seagulls haircut. Jesus Christ.
Oh man, that would be fucking great. Like, every time I see this character, I'm just gonna hear like, and I ran.
It looks like you could stab someone with that hair, man.
It looks like another one, like the big I guess that's the same dude, okay. That makes sense. I was gonna say, it looks like the dude in the next panel is the same, or not the next panel, but the next page has the same shit too, but...
It's the same guy. So they're talking with Joey, and they're like, air, its flavor is strikingly different, and they're talking about that stuff, and so they start talking about Komatsu, because Komatsu prepared the dish and caused it to be so much more refined and so on and so forth. And all these nitros whose names we don't know, so the only way I can tell them apart is pointy-haired one, apparently female one, and badass crossing arms over chest leaning against column one.
Oh, I fucking love badass crossing his arm leaning against column one.
He looks so awesome.
He's my favorite.
So, I don't know. I don't even know what they're fucking talking about. They start talking about pear. One of them is called pear when one of the ingredients is pear.
Well, no, they're talking about the fact that they never expected that someone would be able to get 100% of the full flavor out of one of Acacia's elements, and they're kind of pondering the full extent of what Komatsu's ability at, you know, preparing food is. And, you know, the one weird kind of female-looking Nitro is like, I wonder how much of the full course menu they'll be able to pull that full flavor out of. Mm-hmm. And then they start reminiscing the fact that one of these Nitro met Toriko and Komatsu before, and the fact that, basically, you know, they're going up against the Monkey King, but they can't possibly beat him. And
they cannot win.
Yeah, they suggest that maybe they will never be able to unlock the full 100% flavor of a pair of monkey testicles.
So, we cut to Toriko and company, who are stalking forward, preparing to face the Monkey King. They're like, yo, we had resolve 3 days ago. We had courage, bravery, and something like a strategy. All the pieces were in place, but we were missing something. Strength! Without strength, we couldn't face the Monkey King. Yeah. No shit.
But it's such a badass, like, look at us walking moment. Like, can't you imagine a scene you just put, like, Overtaken from One Piece on top of it? Makes sense.
So.
And Nick, you have to be excited about this ending.
Rotorga says, raging appetite! We can trust in that! And strength! That's all! Monkey King, we're here to play! They came out to this opening where there's a giant wrestling ring.
Somewhere out there, Infamous Planet is screaming that he really hopes it's a boxing ring.
Oh, we are gonna make so many references, man.
But really, I don't know why I didn't notice it until, like, you read it out loud, but I kind of like Toriko's last line there. Raging appetite! We can trust the net! Oh, and strength, that's all! Oh, also friendship! And I love you! Like, it's just like he's forgetting shit as he's going along. He's like, oh, and Basil!
Shit up off the top of his head.
Did anyone bring Basil?
Looks like a bad Roman Reigns promo.
Oh.
So they're like, oh, a ring! And there's a shining light overhead, but we don't get to see Monkey King Bambino's entrance just yet. That'll be next week.
You know what it reminds me of, too? It reminds me of the final fight in fucking Donkey Kong 64, where you had to fight a giant King K. Rool in a big boxing ring and a switch between your characters. This is a fun fucking boss fight.
Just in time for the Royal Rumble, too.
Yeah. I was trying to stay away from wrestling references. Just so
come on, it's a wrestling...
Just so we can give him this planet one
week. If he
shows
up in shorts with boxing gloves on all four of his hands, I'm just like, God, that's kind of awesome, but I wish we were a wrestling
man. Shows up with boxing gloves on his balls.
Does knock out punches by teabagging all four of them.
That'd be great. But he still acts acts and talks like fucking Macho Man.
Well, obviously, that's how he has fun. You know, like how 12-year-olds on Xbox Live have fun.
Yeah, so they beat you and then teabags you, but beat you while teabagging you. It's a double whammy. All
right. Okay. World Trigger. Last time, of course, the fight between the three teams was in full swing. We open this chapter with a little bit of a flashback to when Tamakoma's squad was preparing for the battle, and they were studying into all hours of the night, although apparently it was only 11:20, so what the fuck are you guys complaining about? Wusses.
You're just like, fucking, why don't you go to bed, Grandma? It's only 11 o'clock.
So... Reiji came in and said, hey, Yuma, you're on defense duty with me, so we're going to walk Chika home, and then we'll just come back here and do our defense duty. And then he turned to Osamu and said, you've been at this since yesterday. Call it a night already. And so he's like, I got to find a way to defeat Arafune Squad's formation. And you can tell that I've been away for a long time because my normally doofy, slicked haircut has random little cowlicks in it because I haven't been able to comb it down. I'm tired. So he's like, oh, we've got all this information. We've got to take advantage of this information because, you know, there's not much data on us. And so Rage says, yeah, you've got a lot of stuff to look through, but it seems like too much of a good thing if you ask me. So, yeah. But eventually he was just like, you know, don't push yourself too hard. And then as Yuma and Chika walked out, Yuma was like, we'll have to make sure we win. And Chika's like, froze your grease.
I like that, like, Chika's just become third person in group. She's yet to really establish any sort of personality or any, like, actions on her own.
Yeah, it's unfortunately just, like, how she relates to other people, like her brother and friend, so.
Yeah, I'm hoping we're gonna get some development from her in due time.
So, meanwhile, back in the prison, the team splits up. Chika goes off on her own in order to get, you know, sniping spots, while Yuma and Osamu go on ahead, and they're like, alright, let's go and get some points.
I must not have noticed it last week. When did Osamu get his hand blown off?
I guess it was when they were blocking attacks.
Yeah, I guess
attacks.
The shields, and it just blew one of his... I just didn't notice that last week, and I just saw that in that panel.
Yeah, it must have punctured the shield at some point.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Alright, so they, you know, rush on ahead. We cut to where, you know, Sua squads are kind of in... Sua, actually, specifically, is engaging one of the snipers. And the announcer's like, oh, the tables have turned for Arafune squad. They're you know, using Tamakoma's firepower as cover. Sua squad goes for the throat! And we get a bit of, you know, commentary on, like, oh, the way the Tamakoma 2 was clustered, it was really tempting for snipers to pass up, and that's why that's why our Arafune squad was flushed out. It was because they were just too tempting a target. And now they've split off because that part of the plan is complete. They flushed out one of the snipers. But then at that moment, they're like, oh my god, it's a gunner's optimal range. Captain Arafune is in trouble. And what's-his-name says, no, they're just fishing. As another one of Arafune's squads snipers, takes a shot at Sua, hits him right in the head, but he has a shield right in front of his face.
Suck it!
And so, like, oh my god, how did he do that? He's like, well, he knew that he would aim for the head, so he was able to concentrate his shield to that very small point in order to block the shot. He knew that he would just be that precise. Sua's got some guts! But then Sua gets one of his legs blown off from another angle. But it's like, oh, it's okay, Sua, you know, it was just considered a necessary sacrifice because now they know where everyone on Arafune's squad is. That's a big deal at this distance, and we see all the different locations on the map. Then the other members of Sua's squad pop in and are like, what should we do? Should we fall back? And he's like, no, we're just getting started, so don't lose them, and let's go after them. Then one of the snipers on our fan squad is just like, ah, Susumi is coming in this direction, but the director is like, look out, it's Tamakoma! And Yuma comes in and nearly cuts him through the chest. He just manages to duck out of the way. Yuma comes back. Susumi comes in as well and shoots the fuck out of the sniper.
He totally kill steals. He totally shoots. Like, Yuma's like, I got this shit. He comes in, he's just like, eh, yoink. Suck it.
So he's forced to bail out, and then Susumi and Yuma end up squaring off as well. And so Susumi's trying to shoot Yuma down, but Yuma is racing around through the air, and Susumi's like, ah, but we already know you can move like that, and he tries to shoot at Yuma while he's in midair, but Yuma uses a grasshopper to dodge around in midair and slice through him to eliminate him as well. And so they're like, oh my god, yeah, he used a grasshopper! And we cut to Tsukishima... Whatever. Not Tsukishima. Jin's brother. And he's like, I taught him that.
Midorikawa's
brother, yeah. Younger Midorikawa. They're like, everyone's like, why would you make your rival tougher to beat? And so they're like, yeah, I like that about him.
Well, I like that's what Yosuke's even saying. He's just like, I like that trait of Midorikawa. Like, he's, you know, willing to make his rival stronger.
So Susumi, you know, after bailing out, you know, comes back in, and he's just like, god damn it, I can't believe that he caught me like that. And so he apologized to their operator, and she's like, eh, you weren't disappointed already, it's okay. Back inside of the simulation, Yuma blocks a shot from one of the snipers and continues to close the distance, and they're like, oh my gosh, when you know where the bullets are coming from and you're fast enough, it's possible to defend! It's tough when your position's known, snipers! And one of the commentators says, well, usually anyway, but in Arafune's case, Arafune comes rushing in towards Yuma, and he draws out a sword, and they're like, he used to be an attacker! And there's a little statistic that pops up with, like, all the different points that he racked up with different attack triggers and stuff. Which, I like that little twist. Mm-hmm. He's so awesome that he switched his position entirely. So, like, all right, everyone's like, all right, let's close position, and it's basically just, like, a square off for the next chapter, but Yuma and Arafune have a little exchange where he says, oh, this is what you're doing? Well, that's fine, and Arafune says, you're so obnoxious, I'm gonna cut you down to size, and Yuma's like, I'm already short.
But, did he actually say that?
No.
Okay, I was like, I don't recall him saying that, but that's a good line. This didn't seem like something to admit. No, I like this chapter. I like how exciting they're making a B-rank fight seem. Like, we know that there are S-rank characters. Like, we know that there are, like A-rank characters that we've interacted with before. Like, and we know that Yuma with his black trigger is definitely at their level. So it seems like this is something that should just be banal. Like, this should just almost seem like unnecessary. But it's thrilling and fun because they're using these cool tactics. They're making these side characters interesting. It's just a really fun, you know, period of time. And I like that we're not rushing through this. I mean, we've had two straight chapters now of this battle. We're presumably going to get another one. And this is, what, the second of three battles for just this round of the B-rank, of the rank war. So we definitely have a lot ahead of us. And it's cool to see this much work's gone into this match, and then you stop and think, all right, presumably they're going to win and move on to, you know, the next match at a higher tier. What's that going to be like? You know, when they're facing even stronger teams,
right?
And they don't have the element of surprise on their hand.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool stuff.
Now people are going to have, like, information on them. So.
Yeah, very cool stuff. Really dug it. A lot of fun.
And that's it for the recap portion.
Yes. Do we want to do any Q&A?
I think we can do a few.
Okay. Let's see here. If you want to, I've highlighted them. If not, I can read them. I don't know if you're
in. Just tell me where you're starting off, I think.
Start off with Master Spark recapping.
Mm-hmm.
Start.
Okay. Alright, hey Chris and Nick, just wanted to say thank you for reviewing Higurashi, even if you were on the series. It may have not had enough horror or what you were looking for, but at least you realized it was really a mystery series, which, trust me, many people who have watched or read the series never realized. Okay. I'd also like to point out that in previous Halloweens, you've stated that mystery series are acceptable suggestions. That said, I will acknowledge that there are weaknesses in the series, some from the source material, such as the painful slice of life stuff, or from it being adapted to a manga format, the heavier emphasis on the time loop, or Shion's focus on the head padding. Other things may have also been changed during the adaptation because the whole harem thing isn't in the other versions, unless your definition of harem is a disproportionate number of girls to guys. But I would only call it a harem if all the girls had a crush on the male lead, in this case only Mion has a crush on Keiichi. In retrospect, I probably would have suggested the last chapter or the chapter that focuses on Satoko as the art to show how mentally unstable the nurse is or just how fearful Satoko is of her temple bestower. Okay. That said, I have a few thoughts on Jump this week.
Now this is when fucking E-Robot was still running in the magazine.
Right. Doesn't the purpose of a robot built to bring peace through racism yet equipped with Opie missiles defeat the purpose a little bit? Sexy armpits. Is this becoming a thing? To me, this fetish started with Hakurai Reimu of the Toho series, but it probably existed before then. Naked apron press plus thigh-high socks. Good choice, Ageha.
I just want to note, Ageha, it's not doing well, but it's not in, like, the bottom five right now, so
yeah,
there's a chance.
Yeah, in the middle.
Yeah, it might. Well, to be fair, there's also a lot of other Jumpstart series that need to be rid of first, but it's possible it may have a little bit of a run to it. It may be, like, the next cross-manage where it gets, you know, a couple months.
Yeah, E-Robot is, like, very close to the bottom, though.
Yeah.
It's, like, the three series that are going to end in the next 3 weeks, and then a one-shot, and Kojikame, and E-Robot.
Yeah.
So, yeah. where was I? Apparently World Trigger was trending on Japan's Twitter last week. Grabbed a screen cap of it and attached it. All I know is that the trending coincided with the anime episode that debuted Chika, though. Still, there's some good publicity for World Trigger, if anything. Also, a new ship has appeared, Chris. Kitamu is in danger. Chikamu is now approaching. Will we ship-to-ship combat? I've already got an idea for a Chikamu erotic fanfic. Perhaps we could have a fanfiction off. Is that a thing?
No, it's not, sir. Master Spark, it is not a thing. And there will be no Chikamu in my fucking podcast, I'll tell you that right now.
I don't really want to read a Chigamu erotic fanfic because she is...
To be fair, did you really want to read an Osamu Kitora fanfic either?
At least they look like they're older. She looks like she's 11.
True.
All right. Let's see, then it's from Brawla, I guess?
Yes.
Hey Chris and Nick, it's me, Brawla. I just want to ask you two a question. Which is important for me as a future writer and as a reader of several manga and books? What do you think about reviving dead characters? Not as a zombie, nor as a ghost. I mean to revive a dead character so that he or she can be alive again through some magical deus ex machina or whatever, like how they're doing it with Pain in Naruto.
So... the question being, essentially, you know, how do you approach the topic of reviving dead characters? Do you like it? Do you not like it?
Brawla says specifically, I hate these myself. I just dislike how some writers revive a dead character for some stupid reason. Death should have been absolute, or otherwise I can't take it seriously. It depends, but for the most part I do agree with you that just like Loud says, like, and they're back now is a tremendous cop-out.
I mean, let's just be honest. I don't think you're going to find anybody who likes the fact that you're going to kill a character and then bring them back. And essentially what the act of killing the character was just supposed to be a false cliffhanger to hold people over. Like, the notion that Byakuya is dead when you know that in a couple weeks we're going to find out he's alive and it was never your intention to kill him or even really progress the story in that way. It's not as though Byakuya or Rukia suddenly had major character developments off of that. You know, it's it's just one of those things, like, I'm going to kill this character and not do anything with it. I've never been a big fan of killing characters off. I think that's one of the things I always really liked about One Piece. I mean, it could be annoying that characters would never die, but I always really liked that they didn't kill off characters, though, because Oda always said he never liked killing characters off, and you've seen that he actually has been able to take advantage of that when he gets to reuse those characters much later on. I mean, if Luffy had killed Buggy at the start of the series, we never would have had, you know, everything that went down in Impel Down with him. You know?
He never would have become one of the Emperors.
Yeah, not an Emperor, he's a Warlord. He's not an Emperor yet.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yet. But, I mean, it's just like, when you were mentioning characters are dead, I held my tongue because I was like, well, we might even think that Mori is dead, too. You know, because they suggested that Doflamingo may have killed him. I think that, you know, we may have actually found that's a character that isn't dead because Moria will show up again in the story at some point. That's a character who easily could have just been killed off. So I like that when, you know, I like that Oda doesn't do that. But I do think there is a case for killing characters. It does raise the stakes in matters. And if you're going to bring a character back, make it a big fucking deal. Like, I think the best case of bringing a character back ever that I've seen was in the webcomic Order of the Stick, where one of the main characters was killed, and it was years of storytelling within the story.
An arduous journey in order to bring him back to life.
Yeah, it was...
It was a huge event when he actually was brought back.
Yeah, it was such a huge moment. It came right after another big moment, but it was such a relief when he finally came back, because you've been following the rest of the characters, you know, who have gone their separate ways for the time being as they struggle to kind of live in a world without their leader. And, you know, it was such an awesome moment when it finally all came back, and it really made things worth it. I mean, you know, you can make death a revolving door, but when you do that, you cheapen it and it stops having any effect.
And this was in the Dungeons and Dragons type of setting where, you know, resurrection is a known thing, but there was still a barrier to it happening. It's kind of like, you know, Dragon Ball became very infamous for, like, they're dead, we'll just switch them back with the Dragon Balls. One of the more effective instances of that happening, though, was, you know, at the end of the Saiyan saga, Piccolo dies, so the Dragon Balls are gone. So we have to go to Namek in order to basically go on this long journey in order to bring them back. And they go through that entire thing in order to finally, you know, get the Dragon Balls and wish Piccolo back, and eventually they can wish all their other friends back as well, because they went through a whole ton of shit. But then, after that moment, and basically every other moment in the series, it's just like, we can just bring them back with the Dragon Balls. And, like, it gets worse after that point, because it's like, yeah, I can make the Dragon Balls so that we can actually bring someone back more than once. It's like, well, and then death is now completely pointless.
Yeah. Now, Nick, I don't know if you consider yourself, per se, a writer, but I know you do like to write. I know you've had ideas for writing stories before and manga ideas. How would you approach death in one of your stories?
Death should be death.
Never revival of anything?
I think that in order to bring a character back from the dead, you need a tremendous justification for it. Mm-hmm. It has to be really good.
Yep.
And you can't do it too much, even if the thing you did the first time was really good. You can't do it again, basically.
Yeah.
It can never become routine for death to just be reversed.
And I like the idea of also keeping death as a rarer thing. You know, if you're constantly killing characters off, you know, you're not doing yourself any good. But when you use death in effective moments, when you... Especially as, like, a surprise when you... Not a surprise, like, bam, surprise, we got you. But, like, a notion of, hey, this is a character who, you know, you liked, but you didn't... You know, you necessarily didn't think something this big was going to come their way. Like, I guess Game of Thrones or, you know, Song of Ice and Fire, I'd kind of list an example of this. There are characters who you see and you're like, this character has development ahead of them. I mean, fuck, look at Ned Stark. I'm like, this guy's going to be the main character. And you're just like, oh no. I don't know how he's coming back from this. And that's a series that, for the most part, is kind of strayed away from that notion of bringing characters back, with, you know, a few notable exceptions to which I won't get into for spoiler reasons. But I just like the idea of, you know, when you use death as an unpredictable element in a story, you know, I think it could be very useful in that manner. But I do like death to be final. And if it's not final, I want a good reason to why it's not.
Yeah, and then... Like, I lost my train of thought. Damn it. I hate when that happens. Oh, well.
Sorry.
That's okay. There are also stories where death and brought back to life, like it being routine, is part of the plot. And in those cases, you really are just shooting yourself in the foot. Like, you know, Gantz operates entirely as like, oh, you can die, but you can be brought back. You know, it's hard to earn the points in order to bring someone back, but it's just like a thing that just can happen. And at a certain point, it's just like they just bring back all these people because it's just a thing, and that's just the way the world works. And after that point, it's just like, yeah, you can die, and then it's, but who cares? You know, the main character dies. And it's just like, but they can just bring him back.
Yeah.
They'll bring him back eventually. Oh, look, they brought him back. Imagine that. Oh, the main character's love interest is dead. I bet they can bring her back. Yep, they did.
But they never brought back the old man.
No, they did not. And he never got his peanuts.
I like to think old man like peanuts now. And then somewhere they're all happy because they have a bag of them. Old men are like elephants, Nick.
They're gray?
Yes, and they love peanuts.
They have massive trunks and they're endangered and they're hunted down for their ivory tusks.
I didn't say they're perfect fucking similarities to each other, but, you know.
Alright. Let's do at least one more. From Drew Kendall. Dear Y Roller of Time or Roller at Sea, I thought I'd send you a note congratulating you on your series. I've just started listening to Weekly Manga Recap, and I can already tell I'm going to be listening to it every week.
How ironic to would it be if, like, we're reading this and he's already stopped listening to Weekly Manga Recap? He's like, I'm done with this.
Your Naruto retrospectives over the past few weeks, this was sent to us at the beginning of December, have been an excellent way to wrap up the series. Thank you. I waited until after chapter 607 of Bleach was released before emailing you because I had to see if Kubo would do what you said and change Yuhobak's forearm into an orearm. Although, personally, I'd like to see Hyosuke turn it from a forearm into a rear, then Yuhobak could win the fight a la Naruto versus Kiba and just fart in Hyosuke's face with his new butt.
Gotta appreciate that creativity.
I like that. It's like, there is a rear in that word, yes. Also, I think Hyosuke is channeling different wrestlers, first with his eyes going Undertaker, as you said, and in the latest chapter, he started hulking out a la Hulk Hogan. Well, many wrestlers hulk out.
Yeah.
Anyways, thank you for putting on such a great series. I'm looking forward to more. Why'd you mark this, Chris? There's no question here.
I don't always mark them with their questions. I think if what they're saying is interesting, I'll mark it as well.
Okay.
Don't shit on me.
Okay. Let's see. Derek Cateau says, even if Giselle turned out to have a penis, as suggested by Yumichika, she clearly presents and identifies as female. Kuba may have accidentally created a transgender woman character. Just because he doesn't handle the character or the subject with any grace doesn't mean the readers should be just as crass. This email is titled Giselle is Not Male. I actually challenge your assertion because Giselle at no point seems to have actually identified either way.
I do agree with the notion that Giselle seems to identify as a
did
female.
Did take offense when Yumichika referred to them as male?
Yeah, I feel like if you are to like dig into it, I think Giselle does identify herself as a female. And it may be that this is sort of a interesting case of Kubo creating a transgender character, but I don't think that's what he's going for. I think this is just a character who dresses like a woman and acts like a woman because it's what Kubo thinks is weird. So while I have tried to like only use the female pronoun in describing the character, I really don't think that's what Kubo's trying to go for at all in this. So
may not be transgender, may just be a transvestite.
Yeah. It's just a weird thing. I think it's just Kubo creating a character who has a quirk that he thinks is weird for the sake of being weird. But for the sake of being polite, you know, I have tried to use just the female pronoun.
When I have had great pronoun confusion,
yes.
I'll admit.
It is tough to understand.
Is it
too,
is
yeah.
Giselle a male? Is just me? I don't know. Okay. Alright. From JBL.
Not the wrestler, from Mr. Bacon Lefkowitz.
Jonah Bacon Lefkowitz. Hi guys, loved last week's episode, and I greatly enjoyed Chris's GFT Let's Play.
Game of Thrones. I did the Telltale Let's Play.
I'm really happy a lot of the older episodes of Weekly Manga Recap are on the new site, but I can no longer temporarily download the episode. Before, there was a link under the episode where you could temporarily download the episode. This was really nice, since I could listen to the podcast via iPhone, on the go, or when I was working out. I can still do this via the old website, but once that gets shut down, I'm not sure I'll be able to do it anymore. I understand the site just went up, and it will most likely get added later. I was just wondering if that function was going to be added.
This is in regards to the fact that Weekly Manga Recap, or not Weekly Manga, That Guy with the Glasses is now Channel Awesome, and currently on the Channel Awesome site, the MP3s aren't with the videos itself. That is the situation right now, and I don't know if that's something that's going to necessarily change. I've been throwing the MP3 up, but at this point, I just don't feel it's honestly all that necessary to have it on the website, because we now have weeklymangarecap.podbean.com,
where you can download the MP3.
Yeah, which is a place where you can go to download the MP3, and I'm going to work to get the last remaining like a year and a half worth of episodes on it now. So it may not be on the website, but if you still want to download the episode, you absolutely can still do that from the Podbean site or through iTunes.
Right. Also, a question for the podcast. If you could make a pirate crew with characters from One Piece without including members of the Straw Hats, who would they be? Well, I think Bartolomeo.
Yeah, he's not a Straw Hat yet, so he automatically makes it in. I'm going to make Buggy the captain.
Okay.
I'm going to make Ace the first mate. He's not dead anymore. He comes back.
Ace's corpse.
Yeah. Ace's fucking magma soaked core fucking whole corpse is up there, like on puppet strings. Like, hey, everybody!
Yeah,
let's go have adventures!
Doflamingo is on the crew too, so he can control Ace's magma corpse.
Everyone's just like, wow, this is really offensive, but I'm not fucking with Doflamingo to stop this. Let's see, I need a female in the crew. I'm trying to think of a good side. Let's put Cammy in there. A little mermaid. Let's get some mermaid action in there.
Okay.
And I kind of want one more, like, wacky, fun person in there.
Oh, there's so few wacky characters.
I know. I'm trying to think of a wacky character in One Piece, and I just can't. Well, you know, Persona. I want to put Persona in there. Not Persona. What was her name? Perona. I want to put Perona in there. That'll round out my crew. Nobody can navigate or fucking cook worth a damn on this ship, but it'll fucking be fun.
Let's see here. A pirate crew with characters from One Piece, including members of the Straw Hats. I think that I would have to have Buggy as well. Let's see. Crocodile, because I think Crocodile's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Mr. Two.
Okay, I can see that.
Whitebeard's corpse.
Another person on strings, like, hey, everybody, I'm the strongest man in the world.
But he's controlled by Morians. I'm sorry.
He put his shadow in a zombie that tries to punch things, but he doesn't have the devil fruit power, so it just fucking, like, it just hits air, and he's like, where are the earthquakes?
And, Shirahoshi.
Shirahoshi? Alright. Yeah. Like
just to have a female crew member there. It was just like,
fucking wet. Why, it's a Shirahoshi. Wet. That's a wet fart of a female character in One Piece, but alright, fair enough.
Poor woman.
You could put fucking Shaky in there or something instead. Come on now.
It
could be. I don't remember.
Let's see here. Another question from Brawler. This time I have a question for Q&A and a recommendation. The recommendation, we'll skip over that. Once a while, Chris referenced Lovecraftian horror, as in Entomie and Uzumaki or Soul Eater, and I never clearly hear what he actually thinks about Lovecraftian horror. Do you like that kind of horror, or do you dislike it? Just asking because I'm a big Lovecraft fan myself, so I'm curious about Chris's opinion about it.
I haven't actually read a whole lot of Lovecraftian horror, but based off of my impressions of it, it doesn't sound like something I'm I'd be incredibly interested in. I understand like the aspects of it and the appeal of it, but I don't really dig too much into horror in general, and the like Lovecraftian Cthulhu kind of horror just doesn't like particularly appeal to me in a way that I want to seek it out and, you know, like engage in it. Like I've had offers from friends to play, but what's that game, the Lovecraftian game,
Call of Cthulhu?
Yeah, and I think there's another one too that I can't remember. Starts with like a P.
Arkham Horror.
I feel like there's one that starts with a P and it has like a sanity gauge to it. And like the moment your character sees Cthulhu, you immediately go insane, lose all your points.
Oh,
something like that. I can't remember what it is. Anyway, I've had offers to play this game, but it just doesn't sound like something that particularly interests me. But even then, I can still see the appeal of it. It just...
I do not like horror of any kind myself.
It's weird. We do a horror month. I still, every time we get to it, I'm like, what a weird month we do.
Yeah. I just don't like horror, you know. But I do have a great appreciation for the mindset of the Cthulhu mythos. I think that it is kind of sickly genius that it basically takes the idea of religion that there is a higher power and stuff and turns it on and says, like, yeah, there's a higher power, and they, you know, treat us the way that you treat ants. You don't care about them. We're beneath their notice, and they're so awful that one day they're going to basically destroy the world because they don't give a shit about us. So,
yeah, I mean, there's cool aspects to it. I think one of the reasons I've always strayed away from it is because I don't want to have to fucking try to pronounce the names. Like, because I think Cthulhu is not even like the proper way to pronounce. Like, I know there's like fucking guides on how you're supposed to actually pronounce Cthulhu, like Cthulhu or whatever. You know, shit like, you know, you need to cut out your tongue to actually respect me. I'll fucking say this and shit like that.
Yeah, speaking tongues, man.
But I do like the notion of it, and I like that element when it's put into other things. Like, I loved in 4E the notion of Star Pact Warlords, which were supposed to be warlocks. Who essentially were warlocks who made pacts with fucking the elder gods like Cthulhu and shit like that. So your powers were all being given to you by, like, the fucking world-ending god who's going to devour your world eventually. Like, that shit I always think is cool. And there are, like, elements to that in, you know, games that I'm playing, like, The Secret World and stuff like that. So I can dig it there.
And I think we'll do more just to round out all the questions from December. From Jacob Gray. To Chris Rolo Larios T., and why Nick Ruler of Freeman Time?
Well, you got that fucking spot on, dude.
I continue to watch the show and continue to enjoy it. Blah, blah, praise. Okay, my question. What are your opinions on manga adaptations? Not anime or video games based on manga, but the other way around. Do you think that manga are a good way to flesh out characters, as in the Metroid and Zelda manga, or are just a cheap media expansion, like with Gurren Lagann? And when are you going to review the Kingdom Hearts manga, Chris?
To answer that last question real quick, I never had an interest in reading the Kingdom Hearts manga because a good friend of mine bought the Tonkobons and he was furious because he's like, the manga sucks, it was short, and it costed more than anything else. So based off of that recommendation alone, I was just like, I have no fucking interest in reading this shit. So maybe we can do it as a manga recommendation at some point, but I've never gone out to read it individually. Not good?
In general, I find that manga based on anime are bad. It just never seems to work going in the one direction over the other. I don't know exactly why it is. I think it's just a matter of if something is actually specifically, you know, created and imagined with television in mind, then turning it into, you know, black and white comic book just doesn't seem to work. And I think that the writer is never very good at adapting it. Video game based manga can be interesting, though. I actually did a video several years back on a bunch of Nintendo manga, and some of them are pretty interesting. The Metroid manga in particular I think is great. It seems to actually really fit in with the idea of, you know, who Samus is as a person and stuff. And I know a lot of people, when like Other M came out, they had like read the Metroid manga and were like, man, this like really pussifies this idea of Samus that I had from the manga. Because, you know, that was like the first game where Samus like really talked. And so before that, it was just like, you know, little dialogues from like they were at the start of certain games. I think that there might have been some in like the DS games, but this was like, you know, the first time hearing Samson's voice for, like, anything. And she was just going, the baby, the baby, the baby. Whereas there was everything else that they had seen with, like, lines written for her made her seem much more interesting and fleshed out. So sometimes manga adaptations are really good, but almost never when it comes to anime adaptations. I don't know what it is.
I have read a couple of video game to manga adaptations. Like, I checked out some of the Fire Emblem one when it came out, and mm-hmm. a few others. I don't honestly have a big preference for them. I honestly just think that when a series that excelled in one medium moves to another, most of the time it doesn't particularly work very well. There are exceptions to this. I think the Marvel comic series is much better now that it's moved into a movie. But in manga terms, most times we've read adaptations, usually one of us at least came away not being very pleased with it. I think when I read a manga, I almost would rather it be on an original idea rather than an adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just what I prefer. If I'm going to read a story, you know, I'd rather read it in a series that was created for this format rather than one that was existing somewhere else that was better and we just moved it to this. And it's not to say they're all bad or anything like that. It's just, in general, I prefer original IPs.
I 100% agree with that sentiment, yeah.
Right. Very good. There you go.
And also, the Legend of Zelda manga are fucking weird because Link talking to himself, man. That's just weird.
Link should never talk.
He's just like, ha-ha-ha-ha-ha!
Even in, like, I like to think even, like, casual conversations still go nowhere. Like, so, like, how was work today? He's like, all right, I'm done talking to the screaming kid. Alright, there we go. We ended on a good note, Nick. We ended on a happy, positive note together.
Okay. Let's wrap up then. Thank you, everybody, for joining us for Weekly Manga Recap. We record this show Wednesdays, usually at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, though sometimes we do need to change it up, so, you know, follow us on Twitter to stay updated. He is at Rolo T, and I am at Y Whirler of Time. We record the show here on twitch.tv/RoloT. Also, be sure to send us criticism, questions, and suggestions for future manga for us to read, either in the comments section or email them to us. Our address is weeklymangarecap@yahoo.com. Special thanks to Steve Mann, our title card artist. You can check out his work at neuroticfanboy.deviantart.com and idropbooze.tumblr.com. And, of course, special thanks to The Infamous Planet, who does those awesome visual editions of our show as well. Sorry for all of the wrestling references we make. Ever, basically. And next time we'll have Gekkan Shoujo, whatever it's called. Gekkan Shoujo Nozaki-kun, that was it.
There you go. Real quick shout-outs, too, to some reviews we got on iTunes from Maginar, Replica Rabbit, and Anime-ikin? Anamani-kin? I'm fucking up your name, and I apologize, because you left a very nice review. But I'm trying to get it right. I apologize. But no, thank you for this, guys.
Please review and rate our podcast on iTunes because it helps us to get pushed to higher in the charts for the category. And remember, all the other episodes are on weeklymangarecap.podbean.com.
Absolutely. All right. I think that's going to do it. Mm-hmm. Any wacky thoughts we want to end this episode on?
Unohana's dead, never coming back.
Oh, man, I was worried.
I know there was no Bleach chapter this week, but wanted to make sure, just because I knew someone was going to be like, "There's didn't do the Unohana thing."
Some dude's going to message you a week later, like, "You didn't do the Unohana thing."
Like, yeah, I did. Fuck you.
You didn't stay till the super end.